This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
For this threat, they are betting. There's a net they can set. It's their pet tourniquet. It is debt.
So it may be bye-bye fiscal cliff for now, but up next could be hello debt ceiling.
The next battle royale in Washington could have costly consequences.
The fiscal cliff was a little scratch on your hand compared to breaching the debt ceiling. That is a self-inflicted wound that is far, far deeper.
I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills they've already racked up.
Clean air, clean water, food safety, public education, public transportation, public housing, public health, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security.
It's wrong to pass this debt on to our kids and our grandkids.
If you think that there should be more spending than reaching the debt limit, then you do that a couple of times and pretty soon you have no public investment.
We can't not pay bills that we've already incurred.
I am stunned and shocked by basically nothing has been done.
Watching politicians all slap each other on the back while the country slips into a Grecian-like formula isn't surprising.
What a ceiling! Mercantiling! Now sends every risk to the U.S. fisc. We learn after trillions. Are there zillions?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. This is our first show of the new year, and as we do during our first show, we're going to take a look at our forecast for the year ahead. We'll begin in the big picture today. We're going to take a look at the consensus thinking. What is the general consensus on the economy? Will it be another up year, or will the U.S. head into a recession? And what about the stock market? Remember last year, people were predicting awful things for the stock market, and we got double-digit gains. Will it be another good year for the stock market? Will stocks be up double digits, single digits, or as some bears contend, is this the year things roll over? So we'll take a look at what the consensus thinks about stocks, the economy, the inflation rate, interest rates. And then we're going to take a look at what can throw all this consensus thinking out the window. What are those wild cards out there? And this year, believe it or not, most of them are on a macro sense, although there will be a few geopolitical events we're going to have to talk about. And then finally, we're going to take a look at outside the box. What are those guys like Byron Wayne, the Doug Casses of the world, Saxo Bank, what are they saying? What are the things that nobody's even thinking about, not even on the radar screen right now, that could throw all of this consensus linear thinking off track? We'll talk about that. And then in the final hour, we're going to take a look at my own forecast. And the theme this year is probably right out of a scene in Macbeth. It's going to be policy, trouble, and a silent bubble.
You aren't sitting there with a cauldron, are you, by any chance?
I'm watching Macbeth right now on my screen.
All right. Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. But before we get to Jim's dire predictions and or his cauldrons, whatever he happens to be cooking up, our technician this week is going to be Charles Nenner. He doesn't seem to be too sanguine on the bond market, but we'll be discussing that a little more elaborately as the program goes on. And for a fixed income report, Rob Bernard. And, of course, Eric Townsend will be talking to us from Mexico about this year's commodity markets. But first, to see what's going on in the markets this week, we go over to Ryan Poplava. Ryan, welcome back to the first Financial Sense News Hour of 2013. It was really quite a bit of kabuki theater. Looks like Congress decided to bulldoze the fiscal cliff we've discussed so much. And they did this at the last hour, the last minute, and the last second. It was probably the best theater I've seen in a long time. It looks like euphoria in the financial markets for now, but what's to come with another showdown in D.C. in store for the markets as Act 2 of Kabuki Theater goes on and we look at the debt ceiling?
Well, the fiscal cliff has been broken down into two cliffs. I'd call it the tax cliff, which was the primary concern for both parties ending 2012, and the second spending cliff, which is what you're alluding to as the next showdown in D.C. So again, yeah, Congress essentially split the cliff into two, and they built a bridge to go from one to the other as they needed more time to negotiate. And I think they thought that we'll be back at partisan debates again in a couple of months, and that's giving the market maybe a little bit of pause here. You know, we've seen the market react negatively to fiscal debates 2 years in a row now, with the debt limit in 2011 and the fiscal cliff in 2012. Moody said this week that the measures enacted this week to see taxes increase on high-income earners, as well as the end of payroll tax cuts, will not be enough to remove downgrade risk. So yes, we'll now be faced with the second half of the fiscal cliff debate, which has three parts coming up: a debt ceiling hike, defense spending cuts, and entitlement changes, possibly, all up for debate in the first quarter.
Of course, you know what's interesting is we go through this every year, and the direction, if you look at the vectors of where we're going, it all goes in the same direction anyway. We have usually more taxes in one form or another, and more spending, even though they talk about spending cuts. But anyway, let's get down to the specifics of the tax cliff resolution from earlier this week. What is the gist of the resolution for any of the listeners that haven't read details? And let's face it, it was very complicated to follow, and I actually avoided doing that during the debate. I just waited for the outcome, and so that's what we want to talk about now.
I figured as much. I did make some notes here. So just the main components, and not everything that we'd be here for a long time. So just the main components that I think everyone should really understand going forward is that the Bush rates end for incomes over $400,000 individually and $450,000 for families. I think everyone pretty much knows that statistic at this point. Capital gains and dividend taxes move from 15% to 20%. That's long-term capital gains. Obviously, short-term gains, you're at your income bracket. Plus, there's the Affordable Care surtax for certain income brackets. Then there's the unemployment benefits. They did get extended for another year, so that was pushed forward. Personal exemptions are going to be phased out for individuals making over $250,000. So that's in there. And estate taxes were raised to 40% from 35%, which the Bush rates were brought down for. And the exemption will remain at $5 million instead of back down to $1 million, which the estate planners are really freaking out about. In some sense, that's a big bummer for all those life insurance agents that were really expecting a tsunami of new clients out there. Sorry, guys. But, you know, all of these measures, they will hurt GDP. They will hurt the economy. But it's not as bad as investors were really expecting heading into the year end. So, you know, the market has risen from that. And what the Senate bill didn't resolve were the spending cliff components I already mentioned, the debt ceiling hike, sequestration, and entitlement changes. And already you have each side digging trenches, setting up bunkers, and laying down tank traps as each side prepares for harder negotiations on entrenched values for each party.
If you look at them over the years as they've gone on, and even what happened over the last couple of weeks that we're discussing today here on the program, if you notice, the long-term solution to our debt problem really never changes as a result of this. And this is only a fraction of our annual deficit. But anyway, when we get to that little, I call it Act Two of Kabuki Theater, but it's going to be some kind of a drama here of a battle. What do you think those negotiations are going to look like in the months ahead?
Yeah, that's a good question, because these debates have had a harmful effect on the market and on company plans over the past 2 years. Obama in December basically said he plans to dedicate his second term to basically blaming Republicans for a global recession if they continued to oppose higher tax rates on top earners. And this week, it looks like he's transferring those threats to the debt limit talk ahead. Like I said, we're looking at a possible, you know, real issue and showdown here, like you said at the beginning of this segment. And let's go to some of those comments he said on the first of the year.
Now, one last point I want to make. While I will negotiate over many things, I will not have another debate with this Congress over whether or not they should pay the bills that they've already racked up through the laws that they passed. Let me repeat. We can't not pay bills that we've already incurred. If Congress refuses to give the United States government the ability to pay these bills on time, the consequences for the entire global economy would be catastrophic, far worse than the impact of a fiscal cliff.
Yeah, you know, I think he's right on all accounts. Congress has enacted these spending issues, and now they're saying we don't want to pay for them. You can't have it both ways. But when it comes down to it, it's fairly clear that Congress will not negotiate on entitlements unless there's a crisis. You know, that much has been clear over the past 12 years. And the contrived threat, essentially, of not raising the debt limit by Congress has been just one of the many possible ways to add that kind of pressure that politicians need a debate over the matter and compromise. But I think the Washington Post Friday really answers your question the best, John. You know, they asked whether the Republicans are really prepared to let the country go into default and take the blame for crashing the economy. You know, I don't think so. The article suggested maybe some Tea Party Republicans are, but many believe that the Republican leaders in the House won't let that happen. Just like we saw in the tax cliff resolution this week, which was passed with only 85 Republicans in the House, a minority of the majority. Now, the Wall Street Journal basically said of Republicans, if they start a fight here, they'll eventually cave in the end. You know, saying basically, you can't take a hostage you aren't prepared to shoot. That sounds like something I just read out of Vince Flynn's novel last night.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm listening to a Vince Flynn novel right now.
You are. I'm reading, what was it, Pursuit of Honor?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he had that exact same saying, something like that. But, you know, in the end, I'm hopeful that some of the investor fear over another debate may be diminished based on what we saw in Washington this week. And the kind of logic I'm reading in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal.
You know, as we discussed here on Financial Sense News Hour, when historically, if you look at the death of currencies or when currencies start to hyperinflate and governments get into this position, they have no choice but to keep on increasing the debt ceiling. There's no choice here.
No.
Otherwise, it won't. And it's just going to go on and on and on. So everything involving any kind of a debate is nothing but theater. And like you say, the Republicans would hurt themselves very badly by trying to say, we're going to put a cap on it right now, because you just can't at this stage of the game. This thing is generally playing out pretty much out of control, from the way I see it anyway. But besides the fiscal cliff resolution, was there anything else this week worth mentioning? I mean, usually there's a lot of economic announcements that come in the first week of the month, and not to mention the new year.
There were some important numbers, like the better non-manufacturing Chinese PMI data that came out, I think, over Thursday. But I don't think anything was really pressing on the market, you know, as a big catalyst besides the fiscal cliff deal, obviously. And maybe, you know, the FOMC minutes, the Federal Open Market Committee, sometimes we call it open mouth, which showed that half of the voting members believe quantitative easing will need to end in 2013. And that kind of moved markets quite a bit. And that was despite the accommodation being data dependent, as we found out in December, with that target of 6.5% unemployment. Now, the jobs data came out Friday and the rate remained at 7.8%. So we did get that data announcement, you know, but we have a ways to go before the target may be achieved. And I think the economic data, the auto sales announced this week from many of the big dealers like Ford, GM, and Chrysler. Same store sales on Thursday, there was some great highlights that really helped that sector. And especially the Federal Open Market Committee comments on QE were enough to cause, here it is, yields to rise on treasuries, and for really all the right reasons. Rates should climb if economic conditions are improving and the need for more accommodation subsides. You know, unfortunately, those aren't good catalysts for gold. So we saw gold fall down in the $1,650 range. I didn't see how it closed on Friday, but you know, investor survey results show that many are still very bullish on gold, with price targets of 2000 in 2013. However, the Commitment of Traders report shows that speculators and hedge funds have been cutting their bullish bets in half nearly since October, as of the week ending December 24th. And, you know, I also read a report that the U.S. mint sales of American Eagles were 25% lower in the full year of 2012 versus 2011. Now, when you think about investor psychology, it makes sense to me that after gold's parabolic move to 1900 in the year 2011 and the consolidation we saw all of last year, that demand should drop off. The excitement just isn't there anymore. Unfortunately, what you get in an investor run, you know, move when you're hitting new highs. So that's what we didn't see last year. So investor demand should back up. And I think that will happen in 2013 with a resurgence of commodity performance based on a recovery in the global economy, kind of spearheaded by China, as we've been talking a lot about over the past couple of months. And you're seeing it now in iron prices. There was an article in the Financial Times last week that prices are up 60% in the last 4 months, and the draw on crude inventories we saw on Friday this week might be enough to shake up investor apathy on the sector. You know, there have been many bottoms in crude oil, nearer $80 and in that range over the last few years. And we were in that range just last month. You know, watch for a possible break in that downtrend in the weeks ahead, as the catalysts are really in place for such a move.
And it's going to be an interesting year, I think, for reporting on the financial markets and everything else. And we would advise listeners to go back to the lobby, get your popcorn, your candy, and your soda pop for Act Two of the great fiscal cliff drama. And this is a movie with sound now. We've come away from the silent movies.
So. Surround sound. Surround. We're hearing it from all angles.
We'll see you next week, Ryan.
We'll see you, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
The public role plays a part in clean air, clean water, food safety, public education, public transportation, public housing, public health, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Forget about it. So if you think that there should be more spending than reaching the debt limit, then you do that a couple of times and pretty soon you have no public investment in the future. So I think that it's a very, very bad idea. And I think that there has to be some maturity that has to set in here about the fact that, by and large, many of the, some of the debt that has been incurred is incurred by Congress, much of it in the Bush years, the two unpaid for wars, the prescription drug bill that gave away the store to the pharmaceutical industry, tax cuts on the for the very wealthy that did not produce jobs and therefore growth and revenue to the Treasury. So they have created, been part of creating this problem, and now they're saying, we're not paying our bills. Well, that's just not right. And I think that's an appropriate conversation for us to have.
Joining me on the program today is Charles Nenner of Charles Nenner Research Center. In Charles, in your recent writings, you've talked about you've been out of the S&P from around 1400, and you also had some recent buy signals. So let's begin our discussion. Here's a new year. We're off to a good start. The fiscal cliff did not destroy the markets. They came up with a last-minute solution. And what really struck me about this, Charles, and I'd like your comments on this, despite all of the worries that we had last year, whether it was Greece, a slowdown in the U.S. economy, a slowdown in China, the fiscal cliff, we had a pretty good year for the market. Could we expect the same this year?
Well, our cycles are up into February, so we're still positive. All the time we had a target of, I don't know if you remember, 1460. That's already half for a year and a half. So every time it was 1460, we sold out. There's a small chance we might take it out right now, but we are on a buy signal, and we don't have a big position. We have certain stocks we like. And what I said is actually it should be okay into February. Interesting is that we were very negative on bonds, and we're looking for cycle low in about 10 days, 2 weeks. What is going to trigger it? I'm not sure why suddenly the bonds would go up again. My economic indicators don't look bad, so I don't think suddenly the economy becomes very weak. So not sure exactly what's going to happen. But as you know, is with the cycle work, we work with cycles, the timing and the levels. Our system can come up with the exact highs and lows. And it's that later in the paper, we will read why it happened.
You know, Charles, you mentioned that right now your cycle work tells you that you're positive into February. And one pattern that I've seen repeated in the last 3 years is we start out the beginning of the year, the economy's doing well, the markets are doing well. And as we approach the end of the first quarter, something seems to happen. The economic indicators begin to roll over. The market begins to stall, lose a lot of its momentum. And we go down into the early part of summer until some kind of stimulus or talk of a QE. I mean, we had QE 1 and 2009. We had QE2 in 2010. We had Operation Twist in 2011. And last year, we had QE3 and QE4 at the end of the year. Could you see a cycle like that repeating again?
No, because first of all, I don't have enough cues during the history of the market to build a cycle. It happened a few times. And then people should notice that every new cue gives the market less of a lift than the one before. And I think they're more or less running out of ammunition. The good thing is, by what the Fed says, is that in now we can look at our cycle work because they gave some parameters which are like 6.5% unemployment and the exact number that they don't like on inflation. And with our economic indicators building cycles, we can now predict when we get to 6.5%. So that makes life much easier. Now we know exactly what we're looking for. If that pattern exists, I'm not sure, because in my model, something has to be recurring 5 times. Usually I need 10 years of data, and then I make weekly cycles. And if they return 5 times, it would equal length as a high. We found the cycle. I don't know if it has happened 5 times. It could have been 2 times. So I didn't really look at it because we have our own cycles, but it's worthwhile taking a look.
Charles, this year is a year where we have the Bush tax cuts have expired for upper income individuals. So taxes are being raised. The unemployment or the reduction in payroll taxes was allowed to lapse. So for average working Americans, they're going to see a 2% increase on their withholding. So taxes are going up. It seems to me that that is going to be a negative headwind. Right now, the economic indicators are looking strong. But what about the impact of taxes? And they're even talking about raising more taxes by doing away with itemized deductions. Surely at some point that has to weigh on the economy.
Well, we have to decide if we're talking economy or we're talking markets. I see myself as an economist. I'm just not sure that I know better than other people. Talking about calculating levels and cycles, I think we're the only one who could do this work. So if I would project it on markets, I always tell people that if you know something nobody knows, it's valuable. But here we discuss something that everybody knows in the market. That's why I don't think it's very important to look at these things, because it's already common knowledge.
When you look at your cycle work, which you say is looking positive into February, what happens beyond February? What does your cycle tell us we go through then?
Well, we're at a cycle top, and we still have to see if this is a major cycle high or it's a temporary cycle high. If you ever have time to go on my website, you can see me present a case in the middle of 2006 where we came up with the level and the date of the high in 2007. And then I mentioned we're going to have weakness in 2008-9, but the bull market should continue in 2013. I also explained it had to do with the sunspot cycle. So all the way, even through the crash of 2008-2009, we're holding up that the bull market should not be over, and at least continue in 2013. So it could be an important high forming in 2013.
Charles, I want to move on to gold. In your latest writings, you talk about a close above 1685 would be significant. We're about $7 away, and a close for silver above 3150 would add to the probability that we've seen a tradable low.
Yeah, our situation in gold is that's interesting. It traded above, but it couldn't close there. I had the following situation. I had cycles on the GLD and I had cycles on the gold bullion. They didn't totally match. One was bottoming the end of December and one was bottoming only later in January. So I said, let's buy some calls longer term, then it doesn't matter which cycle is the correct one. We've been sitting on the sideline since we sold at 1900, and we were looking for the cycle low the end of December of 2012. So we took a long position over here, and I said, if it closes above, you know better than me, I forgot 1685 or 1688 on gold, then we can assume we saw the low.
When you take a look at the gold markets, what surprised a lot of people is when the Fed announced QE4 in December, there were a lot more expectations for gold to head higher. That isn't what it did. Is that what your cycle work told you, that we were heading into a low? So the cycle was more powerful than, let's say, even the Fed's action?
Well, I want to explain one thing about the cycle. The cycle, let me give you an example. So suppose that you owe IBM, and IBM is up 50% in a year. And now IBM comes out with a great number. So the question is IBM going up or down? Well, if my cycle is up, then IBM is going up after the number, and the Wall Street Journal will write investors poured into IBM because they're doing great. If my cycle is down, then IBM will go down on the same good numbers, and the Wall Street Journal will write people to profit because they don't think IBM can do better next year, which means is that cycles predict the interpretation of the facts even more than the facts themselves. So if the Fed does what it does, but the cycle is not such that people make interpretation that's bullish for gold, nothing will happen.
Let's move on to something that has perplexed a lot of short sellers, and that is the bond market. Of course, when it comes to the bond market, you have very powerful interests like central banks who are distorting the bond market through their large-scale purchases to the tunes of trillions of dollars. As you look at the bond market, we've been rallying here for one of the longest bull markets in bonds in at least my lifetime, over 30 years. What's your take on interest rates? Are we getting close to a top, or are we still in a narrow trading range? Where do we go with interest rates, in your opinion?
Well, we sold all our bond position at a much higher level, and then we went long TBT. I think we discussed it the last time we talked. TBT is a stock or a share that goes up if interest rates go up. And it's a very long-term position. So according to me, we saw already the low in the yields, and we expect yields to go up for the next 30 years. Of course, with ups and downs, like I said, there is a low in the bond market in about 10 days, and we have another rally. But I think we saw the low in the yields already.
And then finally, as we take a look at the energy complex, it was a good year for natural gas last year. Right now, natural gas is somewhat weak. We've got oil prices. As I take a look at Brent crude, it's over 112. We've got West Texas over $90. What's your take on energy?
Well, we went long around 86.90 and took profit at 93. So now it's 93.26. We started a longer-term bull market. Of course, it goes ups and downs. The next important high for the moment is projected in the middle of May next year.
Wow. And when you say a high, any idea what that high might look like?
Well, we could go back to the old highs. That was around 143 or so.
Wow. That would not be good for the economy.
Well, especially if it is because there's going to be a war going on with the oil-producing countries, it's not going to be nice. But then we have a reason why there could be a top in the bull market, because interest rates are going up and oil is going up, and that's not too good for stocks.
I would agree on that. Charles, if you were giving some advice to investors right now as we begin this new year, what would that advice be?
Well, that advice, actually, like I said, since March last year when we were above 1,400 S&P, we went out of the market, and I said, don't expect too much. It's a difficult situation. I don't expect too much. I'm warning people, if you didn't go out of bonds, please go out in the next rally phase, because bonds are in for a big decline, and you never see your money back. It's easy with stocks, but if this is the end of a very bad economic cycle, for the next, like I said, 30 years, you should have higher yields, especially if you're in bond funds, you will never get your money back. If you have the bonds, at least at the end of the period, you get your money back. Safety is still the major thing over here. Most people are not into commodities, grains, a lot of opportunities where you can make money. You have to be very careful, and especially careful with your bonds position.
I couldn't agree more, because what I see happening, Charles, is outflows out of stock equity funds into bond funds, because that's what's worked for 5 years, and people are looking at them almost like a money market fund, not realizing if you're in a bond fund, you can lose big money.
Right.
And I think that's pretty sound advice. Charles, as always, I appreciate you coming out on the program. And if our listeners would like to find out more about the excellent work that you do, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can Google Charles Nenner Research Center. If you just put in a Google Charles Nenner, then with a double N, then you get to Charles Nenner Research Center. And you don't have to take my word for it. All time I'm a CNBC Fox channel coming up with the exact dates and the exact levels are all there, so you can play the clips and see for yourself how the system works.
All right. We've been speaking with Charles Nenner at Charles Nenner Research Center. And once again, just Google Charles Nenner. That's N-E-N-N-E-R. And you can find out more about the work that Charles does. Charles, Happy New Year to you. And thanks for joining us on the program.
Happy New Year to you and everybody.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com.
And you knew where you were then.
Girls were girls and men were men. Mister, we could use a man like Herman Hoover again. Didn't need no welfare states.
Everybody pulls his weight. G.R. holds lots sour and great. Those were the days.
And I think what we need to do in terms of education is to look at our government more like a family. Our government takes in about $2.2 trillion a year. It spends $3.8 trillion. And it has a $14.3 trillion deficit. Let's just take all those zeros away and pretend that our government is a family. So this family earns $22,000 a year. It spends $38,000 a year. And it has a credit card bill of or balance on its credit card of $143,000. If you take all the reduction in expenses over the past year that Congress has passed and the most recent increase in taxes and the revenue, this family has reduced its deficit by under $100.
Up next on the program is Rob Bernard. And Rob, sounds like not a good start for bond investors at the beginning of the year. We've got yields up close to the 1.9% range. Not a good start. Let's begin with, what do you see on the interest rate front?
Well, just as you said, Jim, the 10-year in the U.S. is at a 191 today at the close. A couple of other things, too, is kind of interesting. United Kingdom, 211. And what about Greece? Have you noticed Greece lately at 1091? And we've got Spain at a 501 and New Zealand and Australia, 359 and 343, respectively. So it's been a backup in rates. I think it's been sort of a risk-on type trade or scenario, but I think our listeners should keep in mind that no matter what these rates are doing, the Federal Reserve stands ready to continue the mortgage-backed security purchases as well as treasuries to the tune of $85 billion a month. So whether or not this is a sticking point or not, I don't think it's a long-lived affair, even after the Federal Reserve's minutes hinted that they are now starting to think about when to alleviate some of that stimulus they've been putting in.
Rob, what about the risk that investors, my technician this week was Charles Nenner, and he said, look, you know, we may see or begin to see a backup in rates on the long end. If we do, he said, I would not be in bond funds. Would you go along with his argument?
Well, of course. I would much rather be picking my own stuff than letting somebody else pick the long end to chase yield. I'd rather give up a little bit of yield to know that I can pretty much make my own particular ladder. You know, what I find interesting is this last year, 2012, the $3.7 trillion municipal bond market had a total return, meaning appreciation plus income, of 7.3% versus a 2.2% for the United States Treasury market. And on top of that, with little prospect that muni tax status will even be fiddled with in the upcoming tax, I can't help believe that a place to park one's assets still look very good for municipal bonds.
You know, Rob, this brings up investment strategy. Now that we've seen the first tax hike in nearly two decades, the nation's largest tax increase, and I was just looking in terms of what this might mean for investors, whether you want to be in tax deferral or tax free. I mean, if we look at what just got passed here in the wee hours of the morning, the top tax rate goes up to 39.6%. But individuals starting at $300,000 can lose their itemized deductions. The Pease Amendment was brought back. So that adds another 1% to your tax rate. So now you're at 40.6%. We have the Medicare tax of 3.8. So if you exceed $113,000 worth of income, you pay 3.8% if you're self-employed, 1.9% if you're working for somebody else. And let us not forget Obamacare tax on dividends, interest, capital gains, rents of 3.8. So depending on whether you're self-employed or you're not self-employed, Rob, you're talking about a 46% to a 48% ordinary income tax, and that's before adding in state income taxes like in our own state of California, where they're 13.3. So doesn't that change to some extent how you invest? I mean, in other words, let's say I'm in a good-paying dividend stock, which, by the way, are only taxed at 20, not at 39.6. And I think that the market's going to go through a 10% correction. So I'm up 20%. Does it really make a lot of sense to dump my stock if I'm going to give 60% of it to the government?
Oof, that's a tough one, Jim. You got to hope that that dividend stock you put your money into has great growth prospects with the dividend as well as the appreciation of the stock as well. But I'm glad you brought that up. You know, when you think about it, if you happen to live in California, that puts you in about a 59% bracket. That means that every dollar you make, you have the risk of paying 59 cents in some form of tax. So even if you buy a municipal bond that's paying 2.5% or 3%, guess what? That's like an 8% after-tax yield if you're in that truly 60% tax bracket after it's all done. That's just amazing. How could those people in Washington think that this was going to be palatable for the public? It just astounds me how these guys dream this stuff up.
Let's say that you're trying to save for retirement, and let's say that maybe 3% return or 2.5% just isn't going to cut it. What about tax deferral? Let's say that, you know, I don't know, I'm in my 30s, 40s, or even early 50s. I want to get a little bit more growth. I want to be in the stock market. What about tax deferral? It seems like that might make a lot of sense here, too, when you're talking about tax rates that could be as high as 60%.
Well, there's two things that come to mind, Jim. One is master limited partnerships with pipeline companies because, as you know, the income that comes from those is classified as return of principal. So, in effect, if you buy a $20 stock, an MLP pipeline stock, and you've held it for quite some time, and every time it pays an income, it's classified as return of principal. So, at that point of time, let's say that your return of principal has been paid down to where it's worth $10 a share on paper, but the stock's still worth $20. If you go ahead and sell that stock for $20, that differential is classified as long-term capital gain. So there is a little bit of tax deferral that goes on in that aspect of an MLP. However, another one that a lot of people are starting to recognize and wake up to the facts is called tax-deferred annuities. And there again, you can have exposure to all your favorite areas in the market, from consumer staples to utilities to growth, even bond funds, for example, or bonds in particular, and have that growth being tax deferred, and it becomes taxable only when you decide to pull that money out. Or if you don't really need it at all, set it up so it pays to your famous beneficiaries or charitable functions that you pick. So especially now, I think these tax deferred annuities are going to really raise a lot of eyebrows with our investors out there, Jim.
All right. Well, listen, Rob, as we close, if our listeners would like to get in touch with you, tell them how they could do so, please.
Thanks, Jim. They can get in touch with me at 888-486-3939. Ask for Rob Bernard and be happy to talk about your particular custom situation, whether it be tax-exempt bonds, variable annuities, or MLPs. Have a great weekend, Jim.
You too, Rob. Take care. We'll talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at Financial Sense. .com.
More than the greatest debt we've ever known, this is the biggest hole we've ever grown. More than a trillion ways to say we're broke, each day a billion bills goes up in smoke.
members of Congress have gone out of their lanes. They've gone out of what is the regular order of the House and the regular order of the Senate, which is to pass a budget resolution setting up the funding levels for the Appropriations Committee and the Appropriations Committee to actually sit down and deliberate. The Senate hasn't passed a budget in 3 years, and unfortunately, these senators and these members of Congress have said, well, in this new normal, we're going to break the rules, we're going to go out of regular order to stuff pork in. I think that's why the American people hold Congress in such low regard. They can't even get their job done.
More than Bernanke wants to spend, more than Putin needs a friend, no one else could lend us more.
Joining us next is Eric Townsend. And Eric, let's begin with the commodity markets. I'm looking at my screen. We've got West Texas Intermediate crude up about 1% for the year. Gold and silver having a bad week on the idea that the Fed might reverse itself at the end of the year based on the FOM minutes. Your take on commodities. Let's begin right at the top.
Wow, what a week, Jim. We've certainly kicked the year off with a lot of interesting things going on. I also got a heck of a lot of email from listeners in reaction to our final show of last year, and I want to try to get to those questions. There's too many to read them individually, but they're mostly can be summarized as what the heck is going on with the gold market. So I'll focus on that in just a minute. But I'd like to start by just sharing a lesson that I've learned about how to interpret the information you get from the financial media, including us. And it's important for listeners to understand that these guys on the TV channels, they're programmed to try to come up with one message. This is what's going to happen, guaranteed, positively, no matter what, that's it. Markets just don't work that way, and we're not going to insult your intelligence on this program by giving you just one view. And when it comes to gold, we've really got to look at two radically different cases. I see a very strong bullish argument, and I see a bearish argument, and we've got to get into both of them.
Well, all right. Let's take from the positive side. I'll just throw in, I see plenty of QE around the globe, and that would argue that we're in a race to debase our currency. I'm watching what's going on in Japan with the change in leadership there, and there's arguably a major argument that's going to be made that the new head of Japan, the new political leader, Abe or Abe, I don't know how the pronounce it in Japan, is going to put a lot of pressure on the Bank of Japan to depreciate the currency. And we're seeing that reflected in the yen. So let's begin with the bullish argument, Eric. What would that be?
Well, the fundamental arguments, you just cited several of them, are so strong here, and it's overwhelmingly bullish for gold in the long run. And I remain totally committed to a bullish view in the long run. The question is, what the heck is going on in the short run? And the bullish case would be that all of this weakness that we've seen in the last few weeks is all about year-end influences. One of those, as many people I'm sure are familiar, is pressure for tax selling. People want to get this year's tax rates before who knows what happens next year. So they sell their gold holdings and move into another similar investment the following month. Another related issue that's going on is hedge fund redemptions. Hedge funds work a little bit differently than normal investments. Investors in hedge funds have to give notice of their intention to redeem. The hedge funds get a bunch of those all at once, and then they, in some cases, have massive unwinding that they have to do in order to meet a lot of demand for redemptions. One hedge fund in particular, Paulson, very big gold investor, largest holder of GLD, and offers the ability for investors to denominate their holdings in the fund in gold. That fund is seeing major redemptions, and also there's a rumor that Morgan Stanley pulled their seed capital from that fund. That's causing massive deleveraging and unwinding of gold positions, and a lot of people think that the weakness in gold towards the end of the year was related or catalyzed entirely by that. I think it's hard to buy about that, is Paulson's people are very, very talented traders. They know how to sell gold efficiently into a declining market and not lose too much money. What we saw towards the end of the year was a lot of sloppy selling, big, large lots, lots of contracts trading all at once as if somebody were dumping gold. So it doesn't quite jibe there.
That was the bullish argument in why we've seen such a sell-off. And in fact, on the day you and I are speaking, gold continues to sell sell-off down on Friday. Eric, give me the bearish case. In fact, in the bearish case, one of our outside-the-box thinking is Saxo Bank this year. They're predicting gold is going to hit a go back to in the 1,200, as outrageous as that might be. And some of the bigger thinkers are saying we could see a new low in gold. So give me your best shot at why you might want to be bearish on gold.
Well, the argument for the bullish case was all about the idea that maybe that year-end tech selling or other year-end forces were just year-end. The bearish case is, no, it's not just year-end pressures, but this is real and this is happening and it's going to keep happening. And honestly, Jim, that's the view that I'm slowly coming around to myself. Again, very bullish in the long term, but in the intermediate term, I think that what we've seen here is everybody knows those arguments you started the show with, where we talked about Abe in Japan, we talked about the Fed, you know, QE forever, all these things, everybody knows about it. And you have to remember that while that's a profoundly bullish argument, markets don't move on logical arguments. What causes a market to go up is when there's more buyers than sellers. What's happening now is we don't have more buyers than sellers. And this is a very well-known phenomenon in financial markets called buy the rumor, sell the news. It means that people have anticipated so much that QE3 and QE4 were coming, that by the time the announcements actually came, all the buyers that could be enticed by that argument had already been enticed. They'd already done their buying. There was nobody left to buy anymore. And, you know, as we have to look at where the market is, the uptrend in gold that started in 2008 ended in 2011. And then we transitioned for the last year and a half into a range-bound consolidation pattern between 1540 on the low side and 1800 on the high side. We saw 1800 just after QE3, and it looks like we're headed back down to me, back towards 1540, which is the bottom of that trading range that the market has been stuck in. Now, if you look at what happened on the Fed minutes coming out on Thursday, gold lost $50 in about 18 hours in reaction to the Fed minutes. So we have an announcement of QE4, which is massive money printing that's going to go on forever and ever. That doesn't cause as big of a move up as we got from a move down when there was just a tiny little suggestion that maybe they're not going to be quite as forever about QE4 as some people thought. Tells me that there's a lot of weakness still in that market, that there's a lot of people questioning their positions. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do see this current downward trending price channel. Right now, the range in that channel is between 1620 and 1720. If we saw a breakout decisively above 1725, that would tell me that the bullish argument is in play and that we're going to see the market move higher because the year-end pressure is over. But if we continue in that price channel, I think it's back to 1540. Anything below 1500 would be extremely bearish. That would indicate that those 1200 numbers may very well be in play, but it's too early to say that yet.
Eric, let's move on to oil as we begin this year. We're looking at West Texas at 93. I think that has got to make the Fed nervous. We've got Brent crude at 111. And if everybody's correct in saying that the emerging markets are on the way to recovery this year as a result of monetary stimulus, that tells me more demand for oil. What's your take on oil?
Well, we're definitely seeing a lot of strength in oil. We anticipated and predicted exactly that outcome on this show several weeks ago. It's happening now. And based on technicals alone, I would say that $100 plus price target on West Texas Intermediate is very reasonable in the short to intermediate term. But I am cautious, though, because frankly, this rally, as far as I can tell, is based on two beliefs that I don't believe in. We're seeing a huge market reaction in everything in these first few days of the year to the sigh of relief that the fiscal cliff has been solved, and the fiscal cliff, after all, was the biggest issue that markets were concerned with. I don't think either of those things is true, Jim. I think that the fiscal cliff was not solved. Instead of taxing 100% of the people more than we used to, we're going to tax 77%, and it's the 77% that matter that we're going to tax more. So the fiscal cliff didn't get solved, and we still haven't dealt with the earnings cliff and the other factors in the economy. So I think there's a lot of potential risk factors, but for now, the trend is very definitely up in crude oil.
Eric, anything else catch your eye or come across your radar screen in the commodity markets this week?
Something's just come up in the last couple days. Thursday and Friday, we saw a big bunch of exuberance in stocks. Normally, you would expect that to be echoed by copper because, as our listeners know, copper and the S&P 500 are both leading economic indicators. I noticed that as of Thursday and Friday, copper is not participating with the S&P 500 in this New Year's exuberance. It'll be very interesting to see if copper catches up with stocks or if stocks catch back down to the trend that copper is showing. I think that we haven't yet found out, Jim, in these first 3 days of trading in the new year, what the real market direction is. And I think next week will be extremely telling.
Eric, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your plans to bring back your Peak Oil Investor newsletter this year and explain what the letter is about. It's free, and how they could sign up if they'd like to receive it.
Oh, thanks for that, Jim. The letter is something that I started writing back in 2011. And to tell you the truth, I didn't think there were that many people reading it. It's a free newsletter you can sign up for on my website. I was surprised at the Association for the Study of Peak Oil conference recently in Dallas. Three separate people approached me and said, hey, what happened to the newsletter? When's it coming back? I didn't realize it had such a following. So it's going to be resurrected. I expect to get an issue out by the end of this week. It is free. You can sign up to receive an email notice of it at www.erictownsend.com. That's ERIKTOWNSEND.com. And as always, I welcome emails from listeners if you have any questions that you'd like me to address in the Commodity Report in future shows. You can reach me via email at eric.townsend@financialsense.com.
We've been speaking with Eric Townsend. Once again, Eric, thanks for joining us on the program. And I want to take this time to wish you a happy and prosperous new year and look forward to speaking with you in the weeks ahead.
Jim, it's always my pleasure.
Now, here's where the Financial Sense News Hour gets really interesting, as if it weren't always interesting. Coming up in the next 2 hours of the Financial Sense News Hour, Jim does year-begin predictions, year-beginning 2013. And at the end of the year, we'll examine these predictions to see how well they did. First of all, we'll look at what the street consensus is for 2013, both in the economy and in the markets. Then the possible rogue waves, and we'll hear some of the ideas of people who think outside the box. Also checking how well they did thinking outside the box. Maybe they ought to come in from the cold in 2012. And finally, in the last part of the program, Jim will make his own predictions as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.